This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, David Byrne, co-founder of Talking Heads. If you never understood his lyrics for Burning Down the House, here's why.
I thought, let me see if I can make a song that is basically a lot of non sequiturs that have some kind of emotional impact.
The Talking Heads concert film, Stop Making Sense, which many people consider the best concert film ever, has been restored with a remastered soundtrack and released for the film's 40th anniversary. Later, we'll talk about the capabilities and consequences of facial recognition technology with New York Times tech reporter Kashmir Hill, author of Your Face Belongs to Us.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. You may find yourself in another part of the world.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, The Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This message comes from NPR sponsor Stearns & Foster. To Stearns & Foster, your comfort is their everything. So they've made a mattress that's irresistible inside and out. Every Stearns & Foster mattress is handcrafted. Every stitch, every layer uses the finest materials, like indulgent memory foam and ultra-conforming IntelliCoils for the coziness you want with the support you need. Timeless quality for your most comfortable sleep. Stearns & Foster, what comfort should be. More at stearnsandfoster.com.
Support for this podcast comes from the Neubauer Family Foundation, supporting WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is David Byrne. He was a founding member of the band Talking Heads, one of the seminal bands of the punk new wave period of the 70s. The Talking Heads weren't exactly punk, but they weren't like any band that came before them. They recorded 8 albums between 1977 and when they stopped playing together in 1988. If you love their music, or if you never saw or heard them, this is a great time to watch the 40th anniversary edition of their concert film, Stop Making Sense, which is playing in theaters. It's newly restored with a remastered soundtrack. Many music critics and fans consider it among the best concert films ever made. Byrne went on to record solo albums, collaborate on experimental theater pieces with Robert Wilson and Spalding Gray, and a ballet with choreographer Twyla Tharp. He still has the record label he founded in 1988, Luaka Bop. His first releases were compilations of Brazilian music, but then he expanded into African pop and later jazz and gospel, as well as his own solo albums. Spike Lee directed the film version of his 2019 concert Broadway show, American Utopia. Byrne's musical Here Lies Love is currently on Broadway. He won an Oscar as one of the composers of the score for the Bertolucci film The Last Emperor and was nominated for one for the song he co-wrote with Mitski and Sun Lux for the 2022 film Everything Everywhere All at Once. That's a long way to go from CBGB.
It is a long way to go. Who would have thought?
David Byrne, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back. It's been a really long time.
Yes. So let's start with Psycho Killer, the first song Talking Heads wrote, which is on their first album, Talking Heads 77, and it also starts off Stop Making Sense. So you walk on stage with a boombox. You put down the boombox. It plays a rhythm track. You play along on your guitar and start singing.
We'll be right back.
facts. Tense and nervous, can't relax. Can't sleep, bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est?
David Byrne, Psycho Killer was the first song that you wrote with drummer Chris Franz and bass player Tina Weymouth. What was the germ of the idea? Was it your idea to write a song about a serial killer? Do you think of him as a serial killer or just a kind of really bad date?
Yes. Well, I don't know if he's a serial killer, but yes, somebody who's kind of deranged and is a killer. And my idea was, to do something. It was an experiment to see if I could write a song. Chris and I were putting band together, or we had a band, and we played, you know, other people's songs at school dances and things like that. And I thought, oh, let me see if I can write a song. I tried years ago when I was in high school, and it was failed miserably. I said, let me try again. So I thought I would try and write something that was maybe a cross between Alice Cooper and Randy Newman.
Were you fans of each of them?
Because they're kind
of on opposite extremes.
Kind of on opposite extremes. So I thought I'd have the kind of dramatic subject that Alice Cooper might use, but then look at kind of an interior monologue the way Randy Newman might do it. So I thought, let's see if we can get inside this guy's head. So we're not going to talk about the violence or anything like that. But we'll just get inside this guy's kind of muddled up, slightly twisted thoughts. And so that's what I thought I would do. I imagined that he would imagine himself as very erudite and sophisticated. And he would speak sometimes in French. And so I went to...
So that's why.
So I went to Tina, who had... grown up some of the time in Brittany, and her mother's French. And I said, can you help me? We want him to say something pretty grand here, but say it in French so that as if he's going to tell us what kind of ambitions and how he sees himself.
So what does he say in French? I've never...
It's like, I realize my destiny. It's very kind of old-fashioned. I think Tina said this is very Napoleonic. Kind of French. It's very kind of, I realize my destiny, I must do what I must do, things like that.
So I love that song so much. Now, you also sing the fa-fa-fas in there?
Oh, yeah, that was a little reference to Otis
Redding's
song.
Otis Redding, okay, I was wondering about that.
Yes, absolutely.
Because he had a sad song, it's also called the fa-fa-fa.
Yes,
song.
So that was a little...
it's a parenthesis
little,
song.
Yeah, a little parenthesis, a little thing where... A reference an Otis Redding song in there. I'm not
Except
sure exactly
you do the
why.
You do the deranged version of it.
Yes. But, you know, well, that's the subject. That's the voice of the guy who's singing.
Yes. No, exactly. Exactly. A character song like Randy Newman.
Yes. But that was to me, that song was unique in everything that we did, in that once we did it and we started playing it, around the schools in Providence, people liked it. They said, we want to hear you play that song. And I realized, oh, okay. Now I realize I can write a song. So now let me write some that are a little more what I want to say, or what less an experiment in can I write a song, but I'm going to write a song that expresses more what I want to say and how I want to say it, and I experiment with the song format and the way their songs are constructed. And so, yeah, that song to me seemed like a unique early experiment.
So Talking Heads started by stripping everything away and then later adding things in. So I'm going to quote you from your book, How Music Works, in terms of what you stripped away. You wrote, you wanted no rock moves or poses, no pomp or drama, no rock hair, no rock lights, no rehearsed stage patter, definitely no noodling guitar solos. So why did you want to remove all of that? And is there anything you left out in that sentence that you wanted to remove?
I think that covered a lot of it right there.
Okay.
The idea was, I was aware that other contemporary acts, people around us, some of them were adopting poses or clothes or guitar styles or whatever that seemed to be from a previous era, from a previous generation. And I thought to myself, well, those were invented or created by other people, and they belong to them, and they express something about their generation. But how do I do something that belongs to us, that speaks to our generation, that speaks to our concerns? And I thought, well, then I have to jettison everything that went before and be very careful to not to adopt any of that stuff. And it's a big temptation. You know, you want to play in a rock club and all that. There's a big temptation to just slip into the things you've seen other people do that you loved growing up. And I said, no, we have to resist all that. So we have to strip everything down, bare bones, and then allow these things to come back in as you discover something, a way of doing that seems like it belongs to you, that belongs to your peers and your concerns.
But then you started adding things in, and it wasn't the things that you wanted to take out, but it was things like, you know, more an expanded rhythm section, a more theatrical presentation, as we see in Stop Making Sense. Oh, choreography, I might add. So I just want to ask you about the big suit that you wear for a little bit of the performance in Stop Making Sense. And in the credits, it says the suit was built by. It doesn't say costume designer or design by. It says built by, as if it were like architecture.
That's true. It is. And it's also true that I didn't go to someone and say, I just want a big suit. I had a little drawing of what I wanted the end product to look like. Very sketchy. It was just a little line drawing. But it was basically a rectangle with feet sticking out the bottom and a little tiny head on top. And so I went to a kind of small clothing manufacturer, designer in downtown New York, Gail Blacker. And I said, how can we do this? I wanted to, I'm kind of influenced by kind of Japanese theater, the no costume, where it's wide, it's rectangular, but when you turn sideways, it's not fat. So it's not really a fat suit. It's
more like a box.
It's more like a box, a flat box that's facing the audience. And it's meant to face forwards. So we had to realize I had to wear a kind of girdle underneath and put the pants on, the pants attached to this padded girdle thing. And they pants, so the pants kind of just hung down. They barely touched my legs. And same with the jacket. The jacket had a big shoulder armature, and the jacket just kind of hung down from that and barely touched my chest.
The suit has become iconic, but what was it like to inhabit it? How did it change you as a performer on stage?
When I started wearing the big suit, I realized that it had a life of its own because it kind of just draped down like curtains from my hips and shoulders. I could wiggle a little bit and it would ripple like curtains or sheets or whatever. So you could do all these things with it. If I wiggled side to side, it would kind of shimmy around. I could do all these things with it that I couldn't do just by myself. It had its own properties that you could kind of activate that way. I thought it was kind of odd, kind of slightly surreal. It meant something. I wasn't sure what it meant.
I guess it didn't matter. It sure made an impression.
Yes. People have interpreted it as meaning like, oh, this is the archetypical kind of businessman kind of imprisoned in his suit, imprisoned in his whole situation.
But that's not what it was.
Well, it might have been that might be unintentional, but it might be there. But I don't deny it, but it wasn't my intention to kind of, oh, I want to kind of make fun of businessmen.
Right. Okay, let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Byrne, and the newly restored version of the Talking Heads concert film, Stop Making Sense, is playing in theaters. We'll hear more of our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This message comes from Jackson. Seek clarity in retirement planning at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial, Inc., Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Noom. Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Check out The Noom Kitchen for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with David Byrne, a founding member of the band Talking Heads. A restored and remastered 40th anniversary re-release of the band's concert film, Stop Making Sense, is playing in theaters. So let's hear another song from the film, Stop Making Sense. And I want to play Burning Down the House, which is one of your best-known songs. And it holds up so well so many years later. So now it's sometimes interpreted about being about global warming, climate change, you know, burning down the house. Fight fire with fire. What were you really thinking of when you wrote it?
The phrase burning down the house I'd heard being used as a chant at a Parliament Funkadelic concert that I'd seen. They didn't have it in a song. It was just a kind of chant that they started chanting and the audience joined in. And it meant like, we're going to blow the roof off the sucker. We're going to set this place on fire. It's going to be, you know, we're going to have a really amazing time here. Yeah, it didn't mean literally let's set fire to our houses or anything else.
Or the world is burning.
Yes. And The rest of it, I thought, let me see if I can make a song that is basically a lot of non sequiturs that have a kind of some kind of emotional impact. That they have some kind of emotional resonance, but literally they don't make any sense.
I'm so glad you said that because, you know, look, I've never understood exactly what is this song about. I love it and I love the individual lines. But I could never find, like, what is the narrative here?
Yes. So like the film title, it doesn't make literal sense, but it makes emotional sense.
Sure. Yes. And rhythmic sense.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's hear it. This is the version from the concert film, Stop Making Sense.
Watch out. Strange but not a stranger. I'm an ordinary guy. Burning
That's Talking Heads from the 40th anniversary restored edition of Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads concert film. So I'm going to quote you again from, this is from your book, How Music Works. And you're talking about dancing, and you say, a nerdy white guy trying to be smooth and black is a terrible thing to behold. I let my body discover little by little its own grammar of movement, often jerky, spastic, and strangely formal. How did you come up with who you were on stage moving in space and not doing, you know, either like Temptations moves or hip-hop moves?
Wow, yes. I had to resist kind of adopting moves that I loved that I'd seen other people do. And so by that time, I'd worked with Twyla Tharp. She did a evening length dance piece called The Catherine Wheel.
Yeah, and I'm going to interrupt you right there for a second, because one of the things you do in addition to jogging in place is you kind of stagger or stumble around the stage, very intentionally, you know, and it looks like you're almost going to fall, but you don't. And I thought, like, that is so Twyla Tharp, because her choreography is like normal movements elevated to dance, and like stumbling, staggering, that's one of those normal movements that I've seen her use.
Yes. So I was around when they were rehearsing things and doing a lot of that kind of movement. Not that I lifted any directly, but I thought, this is the vocabulary of what's available. What you can do is really wide.
So you were inspired by her.
I was inspired by her and the stuff that she was doing. Mm-hmm. I was inspired by a lot of folk dance or a dance that I'd seen on kind of ethnographic films of rituals and like on stumbling and the stuff on Once in a Lifetime by kind of the Baptist church, people going into trance, whether it was in Baptist church or in Santeria or whatever. I thought, they might not think of it this way, but it's a kind of dance. It may not be choreographed in the same kind of way, but it is a kind of dance. It's definitely movement, and it's definitely connected with music. So I thought, okay, I'm not going to copy that, but that direction is someplace I can go as well.
I want to go back to the early days of Talking Heads. I want you to describe your first night at CBGB on a double bill with the Ramones. You opened for them. CBGB was like the most famous of the New York punk new wave clubs in the 70s. Did you already know the Ramones when you opened for them?
We opened for the Ramones, I think, probably the first time. We didn't know them that well personally. We'd maybe said hello.
But musically? But
musically, yes. We'd seen them play a couple of times there. And we knew what we were dealing with. We knew
What were you dealing with?
We knew that they did kind of hilarious pop songs, but musically it was like this roar. It was like standing next to a jet engine or something. We often got called, you know, an art rock band, but I think we also thought that the Ramones were very much an art rock band. It was very conceptual, what they did and how they did it and how they looked, and it was all very considered. So we really liked it. We didn't want to sound like them. That wasn't what we were doing, but we liked it. But we realized, wow, I don't think we can play after them. The audience will be kind of stunned and maybe slightly deaf. But so we'll go before. And it was a wonderful time when the audiences were just curious about what was this new kind of pop music that was emerging downtown and in different places in London and elsewhere. They didn't know much about any of it. So they were just curious and they would go, oh, this band, you know, sounds like a jet engine playing pop music, and this one is kind of this twitchy, kind of angsty songs as well. And they accepted all of it.
So you were considered part of the punk new wave scene in New York. When I interviewed Seymour Stein, the co-founder of Sire Records, the label that signed Talking Heads, he told me that he came up with the expression New Wave because the promotion people for Sire were describing Talking Heads as punk, but Stein thought you were, quote, the furthest thing from punk. Did you feel like the furthest thing from punk?
We felt that, yes, musically we sounded very, very different. And visually we felt very, very different than what was then considered punk rock. But this kind of DIY, the do-it-yourself idea that was prevalent amongst the punk rockers and us, we thought we have that in common. We have in common the fact that, okay, we can do it, and we can do it with the means that we have available, and we can speak to the concerns of our generation and our contemporaries, and they felt the same way.
You've often been described as not the most social person. I heard read one description that at a party you'd be the person sitting alone in the corner. So as somebody who I assume is something of a loner socially, I don't know, I'm just...
Less so now, but yes, there was definitely a time when that was the case.
So,
and
so,
I have to make clear that that didn't mean I was unhappy.
No, right. But being somebody who was more of a loner than, you know, a group person, what was it like for you to be, or at least be perceived as, part of a scene?
At first, I found it really annoying because I thought of myself and what we were doing as being very unique and being part of a whole kind of scene or style or name or whatever it might be. I thought, no, just listen to us for what we are. But then later on, I realized, oh, having a kind of handle like this has been very handy for the press to say, okay, we're going to write an article about punk rock. And we'd get included in that, which was, for us, not a bad thing. And I realized, we benefited by riding on the coattails of that. And then eventually people got to know us for what we were.
You've described yourself as being on the autism spectrum, although you've never been officially diagnosed. Can I ask what makes you think you're on the spectrum?
A friend told me. This was, what year was it? My early 2000s, late 90s, maybe. A friend of mine picked up a book about the autism spectrum, which was kind of it's an old idea, but it's an old idea that had come back into vogue at that point. And she read aloud to me the various aspects of people who are on the spectrum. And then she said, David, this sounds like you. And I couldn't disagree, at least on the mild end of the spectrum.
So what sounded like you? What characteristics?
Kind of the ability to kind of intensely focus on something that interested you, to kind of exclude other things and really kind of be intensely focused, maybe being somewhat socially awkward, socially uncomfortable a little bit, taking things sometimes very literally, which I still do that a bit. When sometimes having a conversation with someone, they'll say something, and by the tone of their voice or their look or whatever, they'll understand that they're telling me no. But I'll hear them say yes, the word, you know, yes or whatever. And so I'll go, but you said yes. What? I don't understand. So, there's a little confusion there sometimes. But those were the main symptoms that I can remember.
What about, like, repeating things over and over, whether it's, like, listening to something over and over again or seeing something over and over again or doing a gesture or a movement over and over again?
Wow. I hadn't even thought of that. I think you might be right. I mean, some of that is what dancing is.
Especially when you're doing the same movement over and over.
Yes. That sometimes there's a kind that, there's a... an attachment to that kind of repetition, that it actually has when something is repeated, it has a different meaning than when it's done just once.
Do you find it soothing?
Yes.
Yes. So when your friends had suggested that maybe you're on the autism spectrum, and you thought, yeah, maybe, why didn't you bother to get an official diagnosis?
Probably because I thought, this is just me. I'm not unhappy. I might be a little bit different than some other people, but I'm not unhappy. This is the way I experience the world, but I'm doing fine. I really enjoy writing the songs and performing and the other things that we do. Why act like I have something wrong that needs to be treated?
I just want to say it has been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been too long.
Yes, you were on our show in 1992. A long time ago.
Yeah,
it's great to talk again.
You too. Thank you very much.
David Byrne co-founded the band Talking Heads, a restored and remastered 40th anniversary re-release of the band's concert film Stop Making Sense is playing in theaters. Coming up, we'll talk about the capabilities and consequences of facial recognition technology with New York Times tech reporter Kashmir Hill, author of Your Face Belongs to Us. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, which believes plants and gardening are for everyone. With over 25 years of developing, trialing, and testing some of the most recognized flowering shrubs and evergreens on the market, Proven Winners Color Choice makes it easy to transform dull landscapes into colorful, vital spaces for work and play. Available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide, or learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the American Cancer Society. Every 15 seconds, someone is diagnosed with cancer. By the end of this message, you could do something about it with your donation. Donate today at cancer.org.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Facial recognition technology is convenient when you use it to unlock your phone or log into an app. But you might be surprised to know that your face is most likely already in a facial recognition database that can be used to identify who you are without you even being aware it's happening or knowing who's using it and why. A company expanding the technological possibilities of this technology and testing its legal and ethical limits is Clearview AI. It's a startup whose clients already include some law enforcement and government agencies. If you haven't already heard of it, it's in part because the company didn't want you to know it existed. It did its best to remain secretive until it was exposed by my guest, Kashmir Hill. She's a New York Times tech reporter who first wrote about Clearview AI in 2020. She describes her beat as the future tech dystopia and how we can try to avoid it. Kashmir has continued to report on Clearview AI and other developments in facial recognition technology. Now she has a new book called Your Face Belongs to Us, a secretive startup's quest to end privacy as we know it. Kashmir Hill, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us what the Clearview AI facial recognition technology is capable of doing.
So the way it works is that you upload someone's face, a photo of someone, to the Clearview AI app, and then it will return to you all the places on the internet where that person's face has appeared, along with links to those photos.
So we're talking about anything that's on the internet, your photos on social media.
It could lead to your Facebook profile, your Instagram account, your Venmo account, your LinkedIn profile, reveal your name, you know, possibly where you live, who your friends are. And it may well reveal photos that you didn't realize were on the internet, maybe some photos you didn't want to be there.
And you'll talk about photos you didn't know they have on you a little bit later. So let's talk about some of the nightmare scenarios that ClearView's facial recognition technology might create.
So let's think about the worst case scenarios for facial recognition technology. Some of the sensitive uses that I think about are, you know, a woman who is walking out of a Planned Parenthood and there are protesters outside and they look at her face, take her photo, find out her identity, make assumptions that she had an abortion, and you know, write about her online or
mentioning her name,
you know, harass her right there in the moment. Or for police use of this technology, you know, it can be very useful for solving crimes, but, you know, it can also be wielded in a way that could be very chilling or intimidating. Say if there are protesters against police brutality and the government is able to very easily identify them. And we have seen this already happen in other countries, not with ClearView AI's technology, but with other facial recognition technology. In China, you know, this kind of technology has been used to identify protesters in Hong Kong. And for more surprising uses, like naming and shaming people who wear pajamas in public, or making sure that somebody in a public restroom doesn't take too much toilet paper. They have to look at a face recognition camera, only get a little bit of toilet paper, and then wait a certain amount of time until their face can unlock more.
Who would have ever thought of that? Okay, so in the U.S., who has this ClearView facial recognition technology now? And are there restrictions on who can use it?
So in the U.S. right now, I mean, ClearView AI has been used by thousands of police departments, according to ClearView AI, and it has come up in public records requests. A lot of local journalists have done reporting on their local departments using it. They have a contract with the Department of Homeland Security. They have a contract with the FBI, and they have received funding from both the Army and the Air Force.
So what would they use it for in the military?
Well, in the military, you can imagine this being very useful for identifying strangers around military bases, you know, in cities that we're in. ClearView AI has actually given their technology for free to Ukraine to use in its war with Russia. And the Ukrainians say that they have used it to, you know, identify Russian spies who are trying to blend in with the population, and they're able to search their face and see their, you know, their social media profiles that link them to Russia, that show them in their military uniforms. Ukraine has also used ClearView AI to identify the corpses of Russian soldiers, soldiers who have been killed, and to find their identities, to find their social media profiles. And they have then sent those photos to their loved ones, you know, to a wife, to a mother, to a boyfriend, to a sister, to a brother, to say, look, this is your loved one. They are dead. And it was a way to try to turn the tide of public opinion in Russia against the war, to show them the toll. But a lot of people who saw that use thought it was just an incredibly chilling and disturbing use of the of this kind of technology in war.
There are U.S. government agencies using this technology too, right?
Yes. We have some limited look at how every single agency uses the technology. So I talked to a Department of Homeland Security officer who has used ClearView AI, and he told me about a specific case in which he used it. And it was a case of child sexual abuse. He had an image that had been found in a foreign user's account in Syria. And they didn't know exactly, you know, who the abuser was or who the child was or even where this photo was taken. They were able to determine that it was in the U.S. kind of based on essentially electrical outlets. And so he used ClearView AI to search the face of the abuser. And it ended up having a hit on Instagram. And it was a photo where this man appeared in the background of someone else's photo. It was a photo at a bodybuilding convention in Las Vegas. And this man was standing behind a workout supplements counter. And this was the breadcrumb that the DHS officer needed to find out who he was. He ended up calling the workout supplements company, you know, asking them if they knew the man. And eventually they located him in Las Vegas and arrested him. And so it was really, you could kind of see the power of a technology like this in officers' hands.
Yeah, so there's really been incredible successes identifying child predators, but there's been failures too, where somebody was falsely convicted, wrongly convicted of a crime based on faulty facial recognition technology.
Yes. So Randall Reed is a man who lives in Atlanta. He's a black man. He was driving to his mother's house the day after Thanksgiving, and he gets pulled over by a number of police officers. There were something like four police cars that pulled him over. And they get him out of the car. They start arresting him. And he has no idea why or what's going on. And they say, you're under arrest. There's a warrant out for you in Louisiana for larceny. And he is bewildered. He says, I've never been to Louisiana. And it turns out there was a crime committed there, a gang of people who were buying designer purses, very expensive designer purses from consignment stores in and around New Orleans using a stolen credit card. And they ran a surveillance still of these men. And one of them matched to Randall Reed's face. And Randall Reed ends up being held in jail in Atlanta for a week while they're waiting to extradite him. And he has to hire lawyers in Georgia, hire a lawyer in New Orleans. And the lawyer in New Orleans was able to, by basically going to one of these stores and asking for the surveillance footage, to realize that, oh, wow, this suspect actually looks a lot like my client. And this detective ends up telling him that, yes, facial recognition was used. And so Randall Reed basically takes a bunch of photos of his face and a video of his face and sends that to the police. And then the charges end up being dropped. But this was, I mean, this is incredibly traumatic. And in this case, Clearview AI was the technology that was used to identify him. And that is one of the huge problems about the use of Clearview AI is, you know, if police are using this to solve basically a shoplifting crime, they're doing that by searching this database of millions of people. You know, Clearview says that there are 30 billion faces in its database. And so this is a question that activists are asking, you know, should we all of us who are in that database, be in the lineup anytime a small crime is committed in a local jurisdiction?
You know, a lot of us already use facial recognition technology in our private lives, like to use it to unlock your phone or log onto an app. Do you use it? Like, what are your thoughts about that in terms of what you're exposing yourself to, if anything?
Yeah. I mean, people think that because I'm a privacy reporter, I must be a complete, I must have everything on lockdown. But I am a normal person who lives my life in normal ways. It's part of how I get ideas for stories, is just seeing how we interact with the world and what happens when my information is out there. So, you know, I do unlock my phone with my face. When I was traveling to do research for this book, I went to London because they have police vans there, these mobile vans that they send out with facial recognition cameras on the roof to scan crowds and pick up wanted people off the streets. And so I really want to go there and have that part of what's happening with facial recognition technology in the book. And when I got to Heathrow Airport, rather than having to wait for hours in line, you know, for a customs agent to look at my passport, I just put it on a little scanner bed, looked into a camera, and there is a biometric chip on your passport that has your face print, and it matched me to the passport and just let me right in. I mean, there are many beneficial uses of facial recognition technology, and it's part of why I wanted to write this book, because I wanted people to understand it doesn't need to be an all or nothing situation. I hope that we can harness the beneficial uses of facial recognition technology that are convenient to us, that make our lives better, without having to embrace this completely dystopian, you know, world in which facial recognition technology is running all the time on all the cameras, on everybody's phone, and anywhere you go, people can know who you are and, you know, have it just end anonymity as we know it.
That's a chilling thought. Let's talk about how you first found out about Clearview AI, because it had been doing everything in its power to prevent the public from knowing about it. How did you first find out it existed?
So I got a tip in the fall of 2019 from a public records researcher who had been looking into, you know, what types of facial recognition technology police were using, you know, which companies, how much they were paying for it. And he had gotten this 26-page PDF from the Atlanta Police Department. And it included this company that he hadn't heard of before. There wasn't much online, called Clearview AI, that claimed that it had scraped billions of photos from the internet, including social media sites, and that it was selling it to hundreds of law enforcement agencies. And there was a really surprising, privileged and confidential legal memo that the Atlanta Police Department turned over, written by Paul Clement, who is used to be one of the top lawyers in the country. He was a solicitor general under George W. Bush. He had written this memo for police to reassure them that they could use Clearview AI without breaking the law. And this just caught my attention right away. And I started digging in. And, you know, the more I dug, the stranger this company seemed.
Well, you couldn't find their office. You couldn't find anyone to talk with. What were some of the obstacles you ran into? You found their address, but you couldn't find a building.
Yeah. So the one of the strangest things was, you know, they had a very basic website, and it just described what they were doing as artificial intelligence for a better world. And there was an office address there, and it happened to be just a few blocks away from the New York Times. And so I mapped on Google Maps, I walked over, and I got to where it was supposed to be, and the building did not exist. And that was very strange to me. I also looked them up on the internet, and they had only one employee on LinkedIn. His name was John Good. He only had two connections on the site. It definitely looked like a fake person. You know, I reached out to that John Good and never got a response. You know, I called everyone I could find that seemed to have some connection to the company. No one would call me back. And so then I turned to police officers trying to find people using the app. And that's where I had success. I talked to officers who had used it. They said it was incredible. It worked like nothing they had ever used before. But through the process of talking to police officers, I discovered that Clearview AI was tracking me, that they had put an alert on my face. And every time one of these officers uploaded my photo to try to show me what the results were like, they were getting a call from Clearview AI and being told to stop talking to me. And Clearview AI actually blocked my face for a while from having any results. And that was very chilling to me, because I realized, well, one, this company has this power to see who law enforcement is looking for, and they're using it on me. And also that they had the ability to control whether or not a person could be found.
Yeah. But you were able to see what pictures they had of you. And they had photos of you that you didn't know existed, including photos where you're like buried in the background, but it was still able to identify that photo as you. Tell us about some of the most surprising photos that were harvested.
Yeah, so eventually the company did talk to me. They hired a very seasoned crisis communications consultant. And so I was able to meet Juan Tontat, who is the technical co-founder of Clearview AI. And he has since run my face through the app, you know, several times. And in one case, it brought up this photo that I recognized as being taken in Washington, D.C. And there's somebody in the foreground and somebody on the sidewalk in the background walking by. And I was looking at the photo and I didn't immediately see me until I recognized that the person in profile in the background of the photo was wearing a coat that I bought at an American vintage store in Tokyo many, many years ago. And so I realized, wow, that's me. I can even recognize myself with my human eyes that that's me. But this, you know, this algorithm is able to find me. There was a photo on the internet of somebody I had been talking to for a story. And that made me realize I may need to be much more careful with sensitive sources out in public if something like this becomes more ubiquitous, because I won't anymore be able to trust necessarily that if I leave my phone at home and meet them at a dive bar, that someone can't make the connection between us. So yeah, it was just very surprising. I even at one point covered my mouth and nose, you know, the way that you would with a COVID mask. And even then, Juan Tantat was still able to take a photo of me and bring up other photos of me. It really is astounding how far this technology has come from its early days when it was very buggy and didn't work very well.
Kashmir Hill, thank you so much for your reporting and your new book. I hope this isn't really the end of privacy as we know it, but...
Thank you, Terry. And I do think there is hope for privacy.
Oh, good to hear. Kashmir Hill is a tech reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, Your Face Belongs to Us. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer this week is Adam Staniszewski. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR and the following message come from State Farm. As a State Farm agent and agency owner, Lakeisha Gaines understands the support small businesses need.
Knowing that no business is the same, knowing that we're all impacted by things that are beyond our control, like catastrophes, and hearing and listening and understanding what's important to a business owner, understanding how much is truly affordable and what makes sense at that moment, because a 3-year psychiatrist is going to be very different than a 20-year doctor, and a 2-year sign owner is going to be very different than a 1-month restaurant owner who's just trying to figure out what's going to be on the menu next month. Those are the things that I think are extremely important that come to my experience as a small business owner. It's me figuring out how to help the people that I live with, how to help the people that I work with, how to help the people that I volunteer with.
Talk to your local agent about small business insurance from State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.